Good afternoon, or good lunchtime in the States. This is What Comes Next Live. We go out every week. This is show number 51. My guest this week is Niall Dye, who I know through the Liminal Network, and which is, well, I don't know how we describe it, but a bunch of like-minded people exploring ways to connect to make a difference is just what comes to me today. And we've interacted a little bit through group calls, etc. And we both work with leaders around purpose and change is my simplest way of putting it. There's a slightly different on intro on the webpage. But welcome, Noel. I hope the weather is better for you over in the States than it is here. In your money, it's mid-50s today here, which is
summer. Sorry about that. It's absolutely stunning here.
There you go. So I have a sweater on today because I'm cold.
Well, soon enough, you'll have good weather and you'll look forward to it.
I've done the British thing. We've talked about the weather.
So. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and what's on your mind.
Let's see. A little bit of my background. I am focused on human experience. I'm an explorer of it and a co-creator of it. I like to work with people to create their experiences for themselves. Doing that throughout my life, I've worked as a designer, an innovator, an inventor and a coach. Now, mostly I'm a coach and advisor to people. I've built and led cross-functional teams in hardware, software, and integrated systems, as well as service design and the experiences you might have across various things. I've done that in healthcare. I've done it in industrial equipment and in consumer products. I'm best known in the product development world. I started as an industrial designer, best known in that world for moving design upstream to help our clients to identify what to design based on human needs. And that is now called design thinking, but I call myself a prehistoric design thinker.
Okay.
Well, I'm known for the Swiffer. I don't know if you know that product over in the UK, but here in the US, it's big. Baxter, the robot, and its sibling Sawyer. And, I've done a lot of medical devices. I've been in some very strange places watching surgeries for all kinds of things. There was a period of my life I called the knees to knickers period. I know way too much about that part of the body and the products that we need to, develop for those things, including diapers, for example. Ultimately, I'm all about understanding humans, what makes them tick, and how they're impacted by innovation and the things that we do. And I help others now. I'm more focused on helping others to break their thinking and reach what they want in their lives, whether that's through work or at home. I see leadership as being all things at all times. We lead in home, we lead in the grocery store, and we lead at work. So that's what I do. I co-create those experiences with people. I'm more of an advisor now. Sometimes I act as a coach player on teams, but mostly I'm advising and organizations and leaders to be more creative and to bring creativity into their companies and individual leaders to, as I said, achieve and create the experience they want in their lives. I say I used to work to bring business to creativity, and now I bring creativity to business.
I'd love to take this in any one of about five directions.
But go! I'm a creative act, so I like to just make it up as I go. So go. Where would you like to go?
Well, what occurs to me is interesting. You mentioned prehistoric design thinking. I quite a seminal serendipitous meeting for me was meeting a guy called Colin Burns, who was who'd left as being head of UK for IDEO. As you know, they're into design thinking, and you know he was responsible for nothing quite as big as the Swiffer, which is a fairly big mop in the US, but pretty revolutionary in terms of the human experience of cleaning a floor. Hadn't changed much for many years, but he's also one of the guys involved with. Have you heard of as the design person, you've heard of the Victoria and Albert Museum?
Oh yes. Beautiful.
Well, the city of Dundee had gone the opposite of innovative. It had almost like industrial decay basically. Mm-hmm. And they decided, some, you know, group of city, what, they, very patriarchal term, but city fathers, decided that their city leaders would said that they would, wasn't all men, decided that they would, how could we reinvigorate the city? And they looked at what happened with another post-industrial city of Bilbao, where they brought Guggenheim there, and they went, we need a museum.
There you go.
So, what they, but the genius was they brought the design museum. They brought the V&A to Dundee with an incredible architect. Kenzo, I think his name was, in Japan, doing this amazing, building. It just blows me away. I love human structure, human design and built structures. But it was the design thinking. Collins, one of the guys who helped them form, what they did from an educational standpoint. So they're actually running programs in the city for several years before they could curate and open the museum. So I love the human experience bit. I guess what strikes me is the different directions you've taken it from and where you are now. Something about purpose that comes to me in listening. I remember watching an amazing interview that Oprah gave somebody, which was never on television, but she was talking to Sheryl Sandberg, about a dozen years ago, just as she was coming into Facebook. And it was really clear at the time that Sheryl Sandberg was all about elevating women. What role she'd been in. And Oprah was really quizzing her on when she knew this, because Oprah herself had known from about the age of 4 what she was about.
Yeah.
And I work a lot with people on who they are, not what they do or how they do it.
Exactly.
Who they are. And I often find that people, if they really take time to take time and focus to explore this, that they knew when they, before they were 10 years old. So I just was wondering if in all the work you've done on human understanding and human experience, I was wondering what your, if in, in American English, backstory would be. Like, when did you know you were about human experience?
And that's interesting, Tom. It's a good question, because you know, when you're young, you're following the advice of others, typically. I mean, even Oprah has that story of how she got fired from her first job, right? Yeah. Because she wasn't fulfilling what somebody else, everybody has these boxes and they put us in these boxes and they want us to fill that box. And I think a lot of young adulthood is recognizing what box you should be in or which ones that you don't want to be in. And it's very flattering when someone says, I want you to fill this box. You're really good at it, right? I have a good colleague who refers to that as the tyranny of competency, right? That you are so good at this and I need you to do it. So they stay in that box for too long because it's not really what they want. We're good at a lot of things that we don't really want to do. I'd say that what happened in terms of human experience for me was I was in industrial design at a time when people would walk in with a marketing brief and say, here's the customer, here's what we want, do this. And we would develop these products that would, it was all about making it appealing because it would sit on a shelf or it would go into an environment where people had to choose it, right? Based on what it looked like. You'd have to draw them in by what it looked like. And I was just really frustrated by that because it was just a competition and what curve, what radius to put on the product or what colors to use in the graphics and the like and, or how to gain attention. And, it was during that time, right around that time, that screens came into our lives, you know, that products started having screens in them. And I started turning my focus to that, about the usability of the product, the usefulness of it. Can I actually interact with it? You know, I'm dating myself, but I remember the classic was the VCR that flashed 12 o'clock over and over and over, right? Because nobody knew how to fix it. And I was motivated to fix that, to create a relationship between me and the product and the customer. Mm-hmm. Whether it was graphics or a service, or it didn't matter, I turned my attention towards what the person on the other end was experiencing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, given another opportunity, I have asked myself this question, if I had to go back and do it again, what would I study? Mm-hmm. Human behavior is at the core of who I am. Mm-hmm. You know, who we are, what our experiences are, what motivates us, wisdom. Wisdom is where I am right now. I'm focusing a lot on that, about how you gain wisdom over time through experience, through failure. You do something wrong. And if you're in a growth mindset, You learn from it and you gain wisdom. You know, if you predict this is going to happen and it doesn't happen, do you gain wisdom from that or do you gain frustration and resistance? And, you know,
So you said you started taking creativity to business. Now you take business to creativity. Another word is innovation. I've got one of Tom's many short, pithy phrases that innovation is simply doing different things and doing things differently.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And there is the fear of innovation, like it's a really big, scary thing.
Yeah.
Simply be, people don't mop floors the way they could, you know, it's a simple thought. It's not a radical change, but it can make a radical difference. Innovation could be simply changing your opening hours because we're in the summer because we have longer hours.
Yeah, and I'd add to that, Tom. I like your definition. I think of innovation as being something that's in the hands of the person who's going to experience it. It's not innovation until that happens. Mm-hmm. Up until then, it's an idea. And ideas they're lovely to have, but they're not worth anything until you implement them. When I said before about what's next for me is I've been thinking a lot about wisdom. I have all this history of making these big things happen in people's lives, right, by changing the product, right, or changing the experience or the service to make it frictionless or to create more friction so they learn something or to capture their attention or to create a wow moment or whatever it is. But I keep wondering if we're now, I'm curious what you think about this. It feels to me like we're in a space of too much. Everybody's pursuing that. And we're not slowing down to say, you know, I just bought myself this tea kettle. You might have seen it. It's a Fellows tea kettle. I forget the name of the model, but it has this very long neck on it. And if you pour it too fast, it spills everywhere.
Interesting.
So you have to slow down while you're pouring the tea water, which creates a different experience around the tea. And I love that. Now it's a change to my experience, but it's one that sort of goes backwards.
Well, I do drink tea, but I'm more of a coffee drinker. And as you might have noticed, there's a bit of a revolution of people making their own coffee, and it is about the slow experience. People use like Chemex filters. They will have these tiny thin pouring spouts and pour it over 15 minutes. But I'll link into it. If you know, we talk about I'm really musing on this thing about the human experience and creativity and innovation. I'm going to pull it back a bit into who we are on purpose, and because we tend to think, oh, well, everybody's like me, but actually, no, we're not. We all have our own unique elements. And above all of that sits like curiosity and the desire to create something. Mm-hmm. So creativity, I think etymologically, we kind of look at it and go, well, it's about the desire to create something. And when you said it's not innovation until it's in the hands of somebody to experience it, until then it's an idea. It was what you said almost word for word, and which I love. And so if curiosity drives someone with a lens of human experience to create something that in the hands of the person, they can get a different human experience. It can be through industrial design, but it can also be through, shifting beliefs, for example. You know, smashing some paradigms up and just going, right, okay, well, we can, you know, move more slowly through life. We can, and these are potentially first world privileges. They are, you know, luxuries of, you know, and I think if you look globally at the world, go back 100 years, almost everybody was working their ass off just to put food on the table. And there's still many billions of people who are, but increasingly, there are more and more people who are higher up Maslow's hierarchy. And certainly for you and I of broadly similar ages and stages, we have a lot of privilege that we can slow down. And that's irrespective of you know, financial side of it. But it's like you're at that point where you go, where do I play with my curiosity? Where do I take my skills? What does that look like? And, you know, I was explaining to somebody in their early 20s the other day that they're probably, they work for an investment bank, right, straight out of university. They're probably going to be working 60, 70 hours a week for the next 15 years, right? And they go, no, I can't imagine that happening. And it doesn't look like that on my team. My manager isn't online past 5:30 or 6 o'clock. I said, what do you mean online? So they're not on Teams or Skype for business or whatever. He says, they're probably emailing all hours of the day and night. I says, why would they use email? This is a young person doing concentrated work. Right? They don't use email. They're just doing tasks they're given at this point. Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's what people do.
Yeah.
I spend, when I work with coaching leaders, I spend much of my time getting them, you know, another of my phrases is the less you do, the more valuable you are to your business.
Mm-hmm.
It's not time to think, time to process. And something I just encountered a while ago, a very simple idea is enoughism.
Yes, I love enoughism.
Not minimalism, but enoughism.
Yes. Right?
And so, so I'm a big believer in the slow tea kettle.
Yes.
What do you understand by, or what would your definition be of wisdom?
Oh, wisdom. That's an interesting question. I think of it as, there's a couple of layers because I've been exploring this a lot. You just touched something that's just going to spill open all kinds of thoughts, but.
Cool. Great.
Mostly I think of wisdom as being, as I said, the experience you gain from something not going the way you thought it was supposed to go. And seeing repeat patterns over time, you know, if you're around long enough, you start to see things repeat themselves and you start to realize, oh, this is wisdom about human behavior, mm-hmm. as an example. I think of wisdom as being something that comes with time.
Mm-hmm.
Although I know some young people who are very wise.
And
I think of that as being the giving yourself the creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And the curiosity that gives, and the permission that someone gives themselves to think originally,
mm-hmm.
to not be, I mean, education is important. Learning what other people think about a topic should open your mind, but to think originally and critically and ask yourself, what about this is wisdom? You know, I think we live in a time right now where there's a lot of content.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is rehashed with a new perspective. So from my perspective, this is how I say this thing. I just bought a new book about innovation that is full of content that I learned 10 years ago in a course that I took. And here it is being published now as though this is original thinking,
yeah.
You know, and that's just happening everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of wisdom as being the person who had that original thought. Who allow themselves the space. And as you said, subtly, that work is thinking. Thinking is work.
Mm-hmm.
And just thinking about things and being creative about them and destroying them in your own mind so that something new comes is where wisdom comes.
And oddly enough, this 30 minutes we're taking for both of us is both enjoyable, I hope for you, is for me, and work. Because it is the work. It's all part, it's all integrated.
I gained so much wisdom by having conversations like this, Tom. I'll be in another place and I'll share it. And people are like, wow, it's an original thought from something I just learned.
Well, this is something, yes, and some mutual acknowledgement, which is really cool. To go with the riff, a couple of years ago, I spent quite some time with Chip Conley as he was developing his Wisdom at Work ideas with the Modern Elder Academy. And I went there twice, many, many conversations about talking to him tomorrow. And like a blending of all kinds of different learnings, because he's an insatiably curious person.
Mm-hmm. He sure is.
And one of the elements is that pattern recognition, which you talked about,
mm-hmm.
one of the areas of the brain that actually increases with age.
Yeah.
There are certain areas of short-term memory as we get past mid-40s, 50s, we simply cannot retain as much in short-term memory. I can't spin as many plates now as I did in my 40s. But I can recognize patterns much more quickly.
Yes.
The And so to some degree, it can come with age and experience and making mistakes and learning from them. But I also do, I keep spitting out all these trite phrases, but they're just repetition. And, you know, one is that not all wise people are old, not all old people are wise. So that goes back to that permission to, you know, to think originally and critically, to be creative, to be curious. And so Chip's got this idea from the upper modern elder as being a mentor, both a mentor and an intern. And I have a mentoring, I have several long-term mentoring relationships, which I like those when there's a mutual exchange of energy and you just keep, you know, you grow through that in both directions. It can be knowledge sharing. It can be energy. It can be all kinds of things. And one of those is with a young man who's 25. Mentoring him for a couple of years now. He's younger than my oldest son, right? So, he's a very wise soul, right? And a slightly different spin is that Chip would say something along the lines of, I'm going to mash up his words, but something along the lines of wisdom is beyond knowledge. So I'm kind of challenging slightly your current perception and I'm also learning from you as well. And so it's a dialogue. Around the conventional sense of wisdom is going to typically is about experience and knowledge and having made mistakes and learning from them. So the pattern recognition side of it is really key and the ability to join the dots creatively is really key.
Yeah.
But it also involves shutting the F up and listening.
Exactly.
Slowing
down.
Well, and just like I listened to you talk the first 10 minutes here. I'm not saying I'm a wise elder.
Well, you're very wise, Tom.
Oh, cheers. Thanks. But what I was doing was not thinking about what from my 35 years of business experience is the right question to ask Noel next. I was just going, what comes forward? So I was listening. I hope to be listening and present and then saying, what's the right question to ask? What's the right direction to go in?
Or maybe nothing, right?
Maybe nothing, maybe just the same.
Yeah. Well, we talked about curiosity, we talked about creativity. I think what you're hitting on right now is just peacefulness, right? Just being with it. I've been practicing that for the last couple of years. It's an interesting, I don't know if this has anything to do with wisdom at all, but it's an interesting exercise to not prepare. Just do as you just said, see what comes. Wait, is that wisdom? I'm not sure. I think it is when you sit and listen for the weak whispers of, where can this go? Which is really what I hope for the world at this point, because, yeah.
I've mentioned it. I've probably mentioned it before on one or more of my shows, but it's a bit grand calling it a show, but we do go out live. There is an incredible documentary which can be watched on Netflix called Insai, INNSAEI. And it's by two brilliant Icelandic women. And one of them had been on the absolute fast track working for NGOs for the United Nations and stuff like this and burnt out in her late 20s. Went back home, met up with this other woman who was a filmmaker. And they did this documentary, and Insai is one of those very nuanced, untranslatable into English words. Broadly, it means to see from the inside out.
I like that.
And it has a whole bunch of my presence crushes in there. So there is people who think of it neurologically, like Ian McGilchrist, who wrote this stunning book called The Master and His Emissary, which is about the left and the right brain, but incredibly simplistically. But in there was also the performance artist Marina Abramović, before the pandemic was meant to be taking over the Royal Academy in London, or completely taking it over for the whole of the summer of 2021. And gone quiet. She just takes 2 or 3 years. It's like taking over MoMA for the whole season. But they've given her a complete takeover. She's going to have the whole space to take over, which is a massive museum. And she apparently moved to London just before the pandemic to start getting ready for 2 years. She's probably here. She's probably going to come up with something amazing. She must be up in her 70s now. But there's, you can see many documentaries and pieces on her, but she has spent her whole adult life focusing on what it means to be present, to create an experience. And the interviews with, that they did of her, they didn't just go back to her once, they went back to her two or three times in this 90-minute documentary. You've just got this sense of somebody who's so centered.
Mm-hmm.
An immovable object. And you're probably familiar, but for the audience, there was something she did a number of years ago. She did an installation, if you will, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York called The Artist is Present, where she just sat in a chair and people were invited to sit in a chair about 12 feet away from her, facing her, making eye contact for 2 minutes. And she did it for 60 days, 12 hours a day.
How did I not experience that?
But the most moving part of this was she had had a partnership, a life partnership, an artistic partnership with a guy called Uday for years. And about 20 years before, when they were younger, she was up in her 50s or 60s when she did the thing at The Artist is Present. They set up that they would both work. They've been together for years and people said, oh, you know, what's your relationship? It was really unconventional. And they allowed rumors to form that their piece was they were both going to walk from opposite ends of the Great Wall of China and meet in the middle.
Mm.
And people, the rumors formed that they were going to have this very symbolic wedding ceremony and finally get married when they got to the middle. And when they got to the middle, they greeted each other and turned away and never spoke to each other again. And who was who showed up on the first night and sat across from her 20 years since they last spoke?
I'm sure.
So So I guess what occurs to me is an insight. One of the pieces they talk about is they go to the UK at one point and they go to a primary school, a grade school we call it in the States, and where they've introduced mindfulness
mm-hmm.
as a teaching. And if we could move away from the tyranny of competence and becoming good at maths and English and spelling and writing and all of the industrial age jobs and roles, and actually just focus on being human and curious at a younger age, then we would have more young people who were wise. And that was the key piece from that documentary.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the challenge right now, Tom. You just hit on it. This is the space I'm playing in. And that I love a world like that. And yet we have a monetary system. We have an economic system. How do we navigate it so that people are not poor? You know, it's a tricky one.
Well, I think I feel, and my opinions are that my focus in work is on, I only work with purpose-led leaders, and they can be in multi-billion dollar corporations. And they might not be pure about it, but they must be curious and brave and driven on that path. And
so it's in balance, just to ask that.
It's balance. We can't, the radicals aren't going to, we can't be radical because the system will spit you out. But how brave do you want to be? And it is a spectrum and it is a balance. And I do feel I'm an eternal optimist. And I do feel positive towards change. It was very, very dark, particularly in the US up until last year with the political leadership. For many, and it certainly wasn't inclusive, and it certainly wasn't loving and caring and insightful and mindful. And there wasn't much room for curiosity. It was dog eat dog. That was the energy that was coming from politics.
All the time.
And it's not going to turn around overnight. But it does start with education. It does start with children, and it does start with, so I think it's a lovely aspiration to go, what would it take for our young people to be wise younger? Because it's great for you and I to maybe be considered. This is a wonderful thing to be considered by others, to have some wisdom to share. Which mm-hmm. My mentor who passed away a few years ago, said that our highest purpose is to share what we've learned, which I agree with. And that's really what I'm planning to spend the rest of my life doing. And I do it a little bit commercially and mostly not. And that's really fulfilling. But boy, I wish I knew what I learned earlier, which is a bit of a like conundrum, right? Like it takes the experience to do it. But what if we can have, what if more young people can be wise? And if we define wisdom in different ways while incorporating all of the elements you talked about. So.
Yeah, it's, we could go into this for a little bit. I mean, it's, there are phases we must go through in order to understand what's true, right? That as much as it's a painful thing, I try to look at the last 4 years in the U.S. as a necessary evil that a lot of people had to go through to see how bad it would be. Mm-hmm. Right? If it hadn't happened, they would just hate what was in front of them all the time. Now they can go, oh, okay. They gained some wisdom.
Yeah.
We should talk more about this, Tom.
We should. And we can both see the clock can go, right, okay, well, we should stick around half an hour here. And what I'd like to do is, I do generally like to do this, it's flown by. What I'd like to do, as I would with all my guests, is to just allow you to have some closing words.
Yeah, see what comes. I'm thinking about time to think right now. I came into this call ready to have a conversation, and now I'm very calm and ready to reflect and think.
Okay.
I've expanded my thinking about wisdom. I plan to continue to think about it some more.
And I'm grateful to say I totally echo what you just said. And if you'll stay on the line once we end the show, we can talk for a minute and maybe think about setting up another call.
Okay. Thanks.
And as always, the reason I set up these shows a year ago was to give people the inside on some of the conversations I have, because some of them I just think, oh, wow, I wish people could share that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a small way. We've taken half an hour to share pretty much the kind of conversation you and I would have if we were just talking one-to-one.
I love that. I love that you just gave them others a window into what we talked about. Plus, you recorded it for me to go back and watch. I love that.
Cool. Okay. So let me end the show with that. Thank you so much for being with me to have this conversation. Goodbye.
Thanks for having me.